Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We can't let a Democratic contender get away with worrying about the unions to the expense of poor and minority kids, nor can we let Republicans get away with the same old, you know, local control, federalism, school choice, and only that. And that is not the debate. The debate is, how are we going to have very fundamental change in our system?
That is the U.S. Education Secretary, Margaret Spellings, a Bush appointee, but sounding very bipartisan or nonpartisan there. That was from, and some of you heard it, our special on education from the Aspen Ideas Festival this summer. Margaret Spellings, the Education Secretary. And with that, it's 30 issues in 30 days, issue 6, Education 08. Did you know that out of 30 industrialized countries, America's 15-year-olds rank 25th in math and 21st in science? That stat comes from the OECD, the big international group known as the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Did you know that we have gone from first to 21st in graduation rates over the last 40 years? Now, I will state straight up that I think this is one of the three most important topics that we will do in this presidential issues series, more than some of the obsessions of the moment, like whether or not to drill for domestic oil, maybe even the bailout bill. The long-term future of the American economy probably has a lot more to do with how well educated we and our kids and our grandkids are for the globalized economy. Here is Senator Obama from a recent education speech.
It's been Democrat versus Republican, vouchers versus the status quo, more money versus more reform. There's partisanship and there's bickering, but there's no understanding that both sides have good ideas that we'll need to implement if we hope to make the changes our children need. And we've fallen further and further behind as a result.
So there is Senator Obama from that recent speech, and here is John McCain on education from his convention address.
Education is the civil rights issue of this century. Equal access to public education has been gained, but what is the value of access to a failing school? We need to shake up failed school bureaucracies with competition, empower parents with choice. Let's remove barriers to qualified instructors, attract and reward good teachers, and help bad teachers find another line of work.
We will hear more clips later as we compare Obama and McCain's education records and talk to a variety of guests. We'll also keep the phones open for any question you have about education as an issue in this campaign or any comment. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And, of course, our comments page always open at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. And we begin this conversation right here in New York. Jeffrey Canada is the founder of the Harlem Children's Zone, which focuses on getting kids in poverty into college, out of the K-12 system successfully. And author Paul Tough, he's an editor at the New York Times Magazine and author of a brand new book about Jeffrey Canada and his work called Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. Jeffrey Canada, welcome back. Paul Tough, welcome to WNYC today. Thanks very much for coming in.
Brian, it's really a pleasure to be here.
Paul Tough, we've had Jeffrey Canada on the show a number of times to talk about the Harlem Children's Zone. Why did you write a book about him?
Well, I thought that what Jeff was doing was something that was unique in terms of the way people try and deal with poverty. Usually I feel like poverty programs tend to target one small part of the problem. But what Jeff is trying to do is create a comprehensive system of integrated programs. So there's a charter school that's part of it that is intensive and highly accountable. But there are also programs outside of school that are integrated with that, like parenting programs, a pre-kindergarten, and And that, to me, was a solution that seemed new and that seemed a lot more likely to work.
So, Jeffrey, what's at the heart of the education piece of the Harlem Children's Zone program, or can you even separate that from any of the other pieces?
Well, I don't think you can separate it, but I think the education piece is really important, and it's for this reason. As Paul has written about in the New York Times, there's a big debate going on in education right now about whether or not we should provide young people with all of the supports they need, health care, mental health, safety. Do we need to make sure there's a fundamental platform that our young people have so that they can, so schools can be successful? That's on one hand. On the other hand, there's a group of people saying, we've got to hold teachers accountable, we've got to hold principals accountable, we have to have schools accountable, and we can't wait to fix the whole world before our children become competitive globally. Both sides point to our work and say, that's what I mean. Because people know that we provide young people with all the supports they need in order for them to be successful. So we have a health clinic, we have mental health services, we have psychiatric services, we look at housing and health care and employment, all of those kinds of things. At the same time, and for that, my Democratic friends, they love me. They say, yes, Jeff, that's what we need. On the same time, my Republican friends say, Jeff will fire teachers if those young people aren't performing inside the classroom.
Have you done that?
We have fired teachers. We fired principals. I told the chancellor and the mayor that if my schools aren't more successful than the surrounding schools in my area, I was going to fire myself. And I said that and I meant it. But I told my teachers and my principals, I'm the last one leaving. Everybody's going to get fired before me because these young people, if you believe every child can learn, which is sort of, you know, the wonderful thing, kumbaya, let's go off into the sunset saying, yeah, well, if that's true, how come we have millions of our young people failing across this country, and that's because there's not accountability. I do, however, believe that as Americans, every child has a right to have health care, to have safety, to have the kind of mental health and social service supports they need. That shouldn't be considered some great thing we do in America. That should be considered the floor for every child's education.
Paul, was it your article in the Times this summer that compared two camps within the Democratic Party on their ideologies toward education and whether they need all these outside supports or whether it's more about standards?
Yeah, that's right. What I wrote was that, and what I think is that actually education is the issue that I think is dividing the Democratic Party more than any other. There's one camp within the party that is affiliated with the unions that believe that No Child Left Behind is the big problem in education right now. And then there's another camp that is more of a reformist camp connected with charter schools and accountability that think actually the unions are a big part of the problem. And I think a lot of what Obama's been trying to do is to bridge the gap between those two.
Let me play another clip of Barack Obama. This one, and I was there in Denver in the stadium as he gave his convention address, and this, which isn't an education policy piece per se, but which touches on education, got probably the biggest cheer of anything that night.
Yes, we must provide more ladders to success for young men who fall into lives of crime and despair. But we must also admit that programs alone can't replace parents, that government can't turn off the television and make a child do her homework, that fathers must take more responsibility to provide love and guidance to their children.
And I saw white heads nod and black heads nod, and there were you go, you know. And so which camp does Obama actually fall into? Has he taken a stand? Is he explicit? Is he specific?
Well, I think he's actually trying to create a new sort of coalition. And I think that clip that you played is really important, and I think that it connects a lot with Jeff Canada's work. Ideally, we can have a system in which we are reforming the schools, making the schools better, but also figuring out not just a way to sort of say to parents, you know, you've got to turn off the TV and do better, but help them, give them tactics, strategies, ideas on how to do that, and that's exactly what Jeff is doing.
Do you have measurable results? How long have you been going now, Jeff?
The Harlem Children's Zone Project has been going on 10 years, and we have clear measurable results starting with our parents and whether or not they're reading to their children and making sure their children get the kind of immunizations and preparation to go into, I think, our early childhood programs. We start testing our kids at 4 to see how they compare with sort of kids across the nation, and our 4-year-olds are doing better. And then we're running schools, and then our elementary schools are doing terrific. Our middle school math is doing great. The ELA is not doing great, and we're still working on correcting that. So we're holding ourselves accountable at each sort of level of the education policy debate. But let me tell you one of the challenges for Obama. Part of this is about the unions. And people don't want to talk about that issue because it's so divisive inside the Democratic.
In fact, there's a local story today where the UFT is saying to Mayor Bloomberg or to the state legislature, either you can have local control, meaning mayoral control of the schools, or the mayor could have his third term legislation if he formally asked for that. But you can't have both.
Right. And you know, Randy and I have talked about this issue.
Randy Weingarten,
Randy
president
Weingarten,
of the UFT.
She knows that there are a lot of things we agree on. And there are. She thinks schools should have all of these supports for young people like we provide. But she knows we disagree on tenure. And here's where I think we have to go as a nation. 25 years ago, American cars were thought of as pieces of junk. I won't say what they really were thought of. And the Japanese were making really good cars. But the Americans thought, you know what? We don't have to worry about making good cars. We can just continue to sell cars that fall apart in 2.5 or 3 years. Well, you know what? The unions had to find out very quickly, Americans do care about the end result. We're at the same place with education. We have put out a lousy product, and the unions are holding on saying, we don't want to change, we don't want to be held accountable. Meanwhile, the world is changing. So I'm not against unions. Unions should do, the automotive union should do just what they're doing, but we can't allow the UFT to dictate the standards for education in this nation. We as a country have to demand that we have qualified teachers who produce, as well as, I think, superintendents and principals who produce.
So, Paul Tough, we've heard about the outside community supports for health care and job training and everything else for the parents as well as the kids. We've heard about how he's willing to fire teachers and how tough he is on tenure here and other issues like that. What's your assessment as a journalist writing a book about Jeffrey and the Harlem Children's Zone, how they are doing in terms of measurable results? And he admitted himself they're having trouble with the ELA, which means the English Language Arts piece, and doing better in math.
Well, as you can read in my book, the middle school did suffer the first couple of years. It did struggle. They had a rough time getting going, and Jeff's right, even now the reading scores are not where they should be. What I think is most successful and actually most important about Jeff's work is this system he calls the conveyor belt, this continuous integrated series of programs that starts really at birth with baby college, with working with parents to help their kids, goes through an intensive all-day pre-kindergarten and then into this charter elementary school that has extended hours and an extended year. And that is absolutely successful. I mean, there are numbers that are coming back that show that they're doing things that other schools aren't able to do. And even beyond that, just as a reporter being there, being in those schools, there was a different feeling. In the middle school, as in a lot of charter middle schools where they're trying to pull kids up who are already way behind, there's this sort of feeling of crisis that, like, this is the last chance for these kids. In the elementary schools, it doesn't feel like that at all, even though these kids are coming from a similar demographic place. It just feels like a normal school. These kids are expected to succeed, and it doesn't feel like there's any reason they won't.
So you've been doing this for 10 years, Jeff. Has this been replicated elsewhere? Is there a South Central LA Children's Zone? Is there a South Side of Chicago Children's Zone or anything else?
There are a number of places around the country that are really starting zones. San Francisco has one. Philadelphia has one. Florida has just passed legislation to sort of provide support for areas that want to do zones. Let me tell you the biggest challenge I think other communities have. One is scale. You know, this year we'll work within our zone probably close to 8,500 young people just in that one area. And it's expensive. And if communities aren't prepared to invest those kind of supports in young people, then they end up picking off parts of it, saying, well, we can't do the whole thing, so let's just do this slice of it. And we think that's been part of the problem. You can't attack this problem by just sort of doing isolated pieces. You do baby college and then send kids into lousy schools. You've got to do the whole thing.
So, Paul Tough, are the lessons we learned from the Harlem Children's Zone experience specific to urban kids in poverty, or are they relevant to the rest of the population as well at a time when even middle and upper class kids are doing worse compared with the industrialized countries we're competing with? You heard those stats at the top of the show where our 15-year-olds are 25th out of 30 in math and science, roughly compared to other industrialized countries. Our graduation rates, high school graduation rates, have gone from first in the world 40 years ago down to 21st today. I mean, those aren't just urban poverty problems. Those are society-wide priorities. Those are society-wide lifestyles. Those are, you know, all kinds of things compared with other countries.
Well, I think there are two parallel crises going on in public education right now. One is this broader one that you're talking about, where every kid isn't doing as well as he or she should. But I think that it's another, and I think a bigger problem is the question of equity in education. That really, there are a lot of middle class and upper middle class kids who are doing pretty well right now in school, whereas in poor neighborhoods and poor families, with the school system that we have right now, it's almost a guarantee of failure. A kid coming in from a poor family into one of our traditional public schools almost always comes out poorly educated. And so I think that's what Jeff is trying to attack with the Harlem Children's Zone. And I think it's a problem that needs that kind of focus.
Well, let's take a phone call for you from Marcia in Manhattan. Marcia, you're on WNYC. Hello. Marcia, are you there? All right, let's try Julie in Flushing. Julie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Love your show.
Thank you
for taking my phone call.
Thank you.
I'm originally from Soviet Union. We came here with my parents, my sister and I, in 1979. So I've had an honor and a privilege of being educated in the Soviet Union until fifth grade. Otherwise, living in Russia was not that great, trust me.
But the schools were good, you're saying?
The schools were wonderful. As I came here, I had the knowledge of botany, geography. I could calculate longitude and latitude. I didn't just know the definition of equator and how to locate it. I knew the effect of living next to the close to the equator. Now, of course, my children, I have three girls right now. One is in high school, one is in middle school, and one is in elementary. All three attend public schools. All three are doing wonderful. My older one has an average point, a great average point of 97, and I can say the same thing for the middle one, and the younger one has been reading since she's 4 years old.
Congratulations. Does that mean that the schools here can do it, or are you saying it's up to the parents, or what's your point?
The schools can do it, and it's up to, unfortunately, I feel it's a lot up to the parents. Yeah. My parents were not involved in my education as much in Soviet Union as my husband and I have to be involved. We homeschool our children besides them attending public school.
Yes. Do you think that there's anything about the nature of society? Is there something about a totalitarian, authoritarian government that's conducive to better public education than a freewheeling democracy?
Yes. First of all, in a totalitarian regime, which, of course, you know, no one needs to speak about its many minuses, but the pluses, the Soviet regime was so proud of its wonderful literature.
And was it pretty universal, or was it more the select group of elite kids who the government decided could go on to academic achievement who really got these good educations?
Pretty universal. You could not attend regular public school. There were no private schools then, and not do well in school because you would be ostracized.
I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for a revealing phone call. Jeffrey Canada, how does that make you feel?
Well, you know, I think one of the challenges is that we do have some really good schools in this country. The problem is that a lot of the schools we think are good, when you look at them globally, They are really second-rate schools. Here's one of the challenges, Brian. When we evaluate our schools, we're not, you know, if our schools were just being compared to Harlem schools, we would look great. Even in comparison to lots of New York City schools, we had an A on our schools from the Chancellor's report card. But I know that unless we get our students up to a level of the really good private schools in this country, my kids won't be able to compete globally. And that's what the challenge is. We have to get the whole system to step up, not just for poor kids, but for middle class and working class kids, too.
All right. We'll keep talking about how Obama and McCain hope to do that. We'll play some more clips from the two of them as we continue with other guests coming up in this 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 6, Education 08 segment. I want to thank Paul Tough, a New York Times Magazine editor and author of the new book, Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America, and Jeffrey Canada himself, founder of the Harlem Children's Zone. Thank you both very much.
Thanks so much, Brian, for having us on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now more comparison of Obama's and McCain's positions on their education plans. It's 30 Issues in 30 Days, our presidential election series. Issue 6 today, Education 08. Let's play another clip of Senator McCain. We were talking about teacher quantity, or quality, I should say, a moment ago, and the issue of tenure and when teachers can be fired and so forth. Well, teacher quantity is also an issue. We have teacher shortages in this country. We have teachers in math and science in really frightening numbers who are not specifically trained in math and science. So here's John McCain talking about alternative methods of certification to get more good teachers into the system.
We should also offer more choices to those who wish to become teachers. Many thousands of highly qualified men and women have great knowledge, wisdom, and experience to offer public school students. But a monopoly on teacher certification prevents them from getting that chance. My friends, you can be a Nobel laureate and not qualify to teach in most public schools today. Why is that? They don't have all the proper credits in educational theory or methodology. All they have is the learning and the desire and the ability to share it. If we're putting the interests of student first, then those qualifications should be enough.
With me now, our next guest is Allison Klein. She is a staff writer for Education Week, and she's been following the two campaigns. Allison, thanks for doing this with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
And our phones remain open at 212-433-WNYC. We heard that caller from the former Soviet Union. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll have a call in specifically for immigrants from anywhere in the world to compare the education system in your country of origin to the one that you found here for yourself or your children. That'll be coming up in a few minutes. But specifically for now, on Obama's and McCain's platforms, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's take that McCain issue head on. He said you can be a Nobel laureate and not qualify to teach in most public schools today. They don't have all the proper credits in educational theory or methodology. And he says that's a bad thing. All they have is learning and the desire and the ability to share it. Is that a big issue in the country as far as Education Week is concerned, the narrow path to becoming a teacher?
Well, a lot of folks have been critical of colleges of teacher education, and that certainly is an issue. In general, though, it hasn't been a huge issue in the campaign because it's hard to say that there's a huge distinction between the two candidates on that. Certainly, McCain has had a lot of rhetoric in calling for expanding alternative certification programs, but Senator Obama hasn't said that he's opposed to that. In fact, two of his advisors, John Schnur and Mike Johnston, head up New Leaders for New Schools, which is an alternative certification program. It's really hard to say exactly how each candidate would treat that issue.
Well, let me go right to what are probably the two most stark differences between the two of them that they really are campaigning on. And one obviously has to do with vouchers. McCain has made it very clear that he would give tax money back to parents in terms of vouchers that they could use either for public or private schools. Obama's against that. I don't know that we need to re-debate the vouchers pro or con question here right now, but is there anything you would add to that to clarify their positions on the issue?
Really, on vouchers, you know, Obama has definitely been opposed to federal funding for private school vouchers. McCain has had some very expansive rhetoric on school choice, saying at one point he was for school choice for anybody who wants it. But his plan actually only calls for expanding the D.C. voucher program, which by about $7 million, which is pretty small investment in school choice if you kind of look at mm-hmm. everything the federal government spends.
So that's as far as he's actually gone in his statement, is to expand a voucher program in Washington, D.C. only?
Yes, arguably.
Although it certainly sounded like from that convention clip that we played before that he was digging in on a very broad idea that education is the civil rights issue of our time, which, funny enough, is generally a conservative line. And what they mean by civil rights is that it should be the right of parents to have the government behind them to get the best education for their children if they're black, if they're poor, as well as if, you know, they're white or in more privileged economic surroundings. And by that, they mean education vouchers for any school.
Right. But like I said, Senator McCain has sort of a very limited proposal on this issue.
Moment. They have private school vouchers in D.C.?
Yes, we do have private school vouchers in D.C.
And they can use them for religious schools or independent private schools or anything else?
Yep, exactly.
Did it go through the Supreme Court?
Actually, to be honest, I'm not sure about that, but it must have, or else the program wouldn't still be in existence.
Okay, and the other big obvious difference, which maybe you can help clear up how far it actually goes, is with No Child Left Behind. Do I understand correctly that McCain has talked about freezing funding for No Child Left Behind until they can take a new look at what works and what doesn't work in it?
Well, funding is definitely the biggest difference between these candidates. Senator Obama, like many Democrats and a lot of educators, has said No Child Left Behind is underfunded, while Senator McCain has said that the funding is adequate for No Child Left Behind but needs to be allocated differently. Basically, McCain has said he would like to freeze all domestic discretionary spending, including for education, until he can really look at what's working and what's not. So I'm guessing that that would include NCLB also.
All right. And let's play an Obama clip here, where he seems to go all the way in the other direction and say one of the big or the number one problem with No Child Left Behind is not enough money.
Let me be very specific about two major areas where it failed. Number one, as I said, it did not fund these federal mandates properly. That's not the first time that that's happened. The same thing was true when the federal government said that we're going to fund special education. They promised that they would provide 40% of special education funding. The federal government's never spent more than 18%. So that's one problem. But that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem with No Child Left Behind was how you assessed local school districts, how you assessed progress, and how you used testing.
So Obama, from his speech on education, talk a little bit about No Child Left Behind. I mean, this was, you know, the big compromise, new direction, 21st century education bill come up with by President Bush and Senator Ted Kennedy. And it was supposed to really take race into account, poverty into account, make sure that schools are measuring their racial disparities and are judged by the federal government in terms of their racial disparities, as well as by any average notion of achievement. What are the other, and you've told us that the fixes to No Child that both McCain and Obama want are relatively small. How broad a debate do you think the country needs to have on this?
I think the country certainly needs to have a very broad debate on No Child Left Behind. But to be honest, where the differences are sort of within the two parties are very kind of wonky and, in the weeds in terms of policy. So it doesn't really make for the greatest campaign rhetoric. Out on the campaign trail, both candidates have said that they don't want to get rid of the law. Both have called for fixing it. But it's not too clear exactly what fixing it would mean in terms of identifying which schools are struggling and either helping them or having some sort of sanctions against them. So Obama has said that he's in favor of standards and accountability, but he's also said that the assessments, and you heard some of that in this clip, that are used to judge schools' progress under the law need to be better, basically.
So is he trying to have it both ways on the standardized tests, coming out four standardized tests, basically, which, of course, a lot of opponents of No Child Left Behind don't like how dependent it is on high-stakes testing for evaluation of the schools and for funding flows. So he's kind of for the high-stakes test. He just says they have to be better high-stakes tests?
Well, it's hard to say exactly how much the tests themselves would figure into his accountability system. He just hasn't been real specific on that. There's some Democrats who want other measures, like portfolios, to be part of the equation, mm-hmm. and Obama really just hasn't been specific on whether he agrees with those folks or not.
Let's take some of our many callers. Megan in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hello, Megan.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I was just calling to comment. My husband is currently student teaching here in New Jersey. He took the regular route, not the alternate route, and it's in an urban district. And he has just been just shocked at how poor the quality of teaching is in the district and how the teachers are treating the students. They flat out say to him, these kids can't learn. We don't know why you're trying so hard. This material is too hard for them. Just forget about them. And he feels like, no, they've never had good teaching their entire lives. That's their problem. It's not that the kids can't learn. It's the way they're being taught. And he's at his wit's end with this school and this district. And
are they mostly, Megan, can I ask, are they mostly older teachers who've kind of given up on the kids?
He kind of, I mean, that's what he's hoping, is that at one point they were good teachers. But yes, they have. They do seem, it seems like they have completely given up on the kids.
And it's mostly the older teachers.
It is the older teachers, but the school can't retain the younger teachers like my husband.
Why not?
I think there's a lot of systematic problems in this district that he's in right now. And I think after a few years, the younger teachers kind of get worn out. I mean, my husband's only been there since this September, and mm-hmm. he's already, you know, he feels the children are the ones who are suffering, and this is a high school. It's an urban high school. It's many different diverse backgrounds. Many people don't speak English, and he's fine to take on the role of social worker and teacher. He enjoys that, but the rest of these teachers don't, I guess. But it burns you out, and I think if people tell you enough, like, these kids are stupid or they can't learn, eventually maybe you start to believe it yourself. I don't know.
Megan, thank you very much. I think that's an important call. And Allison Klein from Education Week, I'll bet you hear that a lot. And that teacher burnout, teacher retention is one of the biggest issues.
Yeah, no, it's teacher retention certainly is an important issue. Neither of the candidates have said a lot about it, to be honest, on the campaign trail. Although Senator Obama does have a proposal, Megan, that would basically allow colleges of teacher education to kind of partner with struggling districts like the one that your husband teaches in, so that teachers would sort of get a residency program, kind of like doctors have a residency, and they would work with a veteran teacher for a year or more while earning credentials towards education. And I think that he's said basically that would give a lot of folks an idea of sort of what they're in for once they get into the classroom and really give them a chance to work with this, you know, beside an excellent teacher in one of these, you know, really struggling schools.
Bob in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I believe that actions speak louder than words. And when Senator Obama was chairman of the Woods Foundation in Chicago, the William Ayers-funded group, he was in charge of helping the Chicago schools, and proposals passed his desk that were trying to help math and English programs, special programs. And he rejected that in favor of social engineering programs that did not help the academic ability of the students in Chicago.
What do you mean by social engineering?
Well, there were special schools about, I don't have the actual specifics in front of me, but they helped minority causes, how America was against minority-type programs, as opposed to academic programs.
Well, that's that's not a very specific take, and honestly, we haven't looked into that part of the record, but he did do that, Allison. I don't know if Education Week has assessed Obama's position and his accomplishments with the Woods Foundation when he had that little piece of involvement in Chicago schools. Have you?
Well, we've written about his work with the Annenberg Foundation. I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to. To be honest, it's not something that we've looked at yet in a lot of depth. Although that's something that I think that we may do in the future.
All right, Nina in Great Neck, you're on WNYC. Hello, Nina.
Hi, Brian. First of all, I think you're dead on that this is the key issue for this election or any other. Just a few things. One of which is that one thing that I never hear in education debates, and I worked in philanthropy and funded education, and I still didn't hear it there, is what does it mean to be well-educated? You know, we can talk about testing, we can talk about whether charters or vouchers make sense or what to do about tenure, but I'm still, you know, listening for that definition, and the definition that would provide real common ground for students, almost irrespective of where they're educated. Because I think one of the things we have to be really mindful of is as all of these different schools sprout up, and I helped found a charter school, so I have some investment in it, even though I still remain skeptical. What's the common vocabulary kids are going to walk away with from an education? You know, I think if you take seriously the idea of democracy, you have to take seriously the idea that young people emerge from a school experience with an ability to communicate with one another across ethnicities and other differences, but about common information right. that they've acquired.
And I'm glad you brought this up, Nina, and Allison Klein from Education Week. We're just about out of time, and we're going to go to the next part of this hour. But the thing that was most on the minds of the education activists who were with us at the Aspen Ideas Festival this summer was the idea of education as a form of national purpose, national mission. And they were advocating even national standards because it is global now. We are competing with other countries, and we're falling behind most of the other industrialized countries. Do either of the candidates address that, which can be so toxic because, as the cliche goes, Democrats are against national standards because they don't like standards. Republicans are against it because they don't like national.
That's a funny way to put it. It's true that really neither of the candidates have discussed national standards in depth.
All right. Allison Klein from Education Week, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, that call-in for you, and we'll talk to a guest comparing the education systems in the United States and some other countries. So this next call-in is for immigrants. Compare the education system in your country of origin to what you found here for yourself or your children. Immigrants only. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. It is 30 Issues in 30 Days, our presidential election series. Issue 6 today, Education 08 and Beyond. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. And don't forget, as part of our 30 Issues in 30 Days presidential election series, we have a 30 Issues Wiki. This is not just a comments page. It's a way for you to collaborate with each other to help produce some of our 30 Issues programs. We have wikis on immigration. That's this week's one. Energy, healthcare, and one called Who's the Best President for New York and New Jersey. Help produce the series on our 30 Issues Wiki at wnyc.org/30issues. Now, when it comes to education, we know there's an achievement gap within the United States, but also the huge achievement gap globally that we've been speaking about this morning. By every measure, the students we're churning out in the United States are falling behind in math and science. India, China, the European Union, all surging ahead. And it's not just math and science. It's innovation, creativity, ability to communicate and collaborate, that sense of national mission we were just discussing. So what do we do? And what can we learn from other countries' educational systems? Ken Kay, the president of the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, an organization that advocates for a major overhaul of the U.S. education system, joins us this morning as we take your phone calls if you are immigrants from another country to compare the education system of where you came from to the one you found here. Paul, Ken Kay, welcome to WNYC.
Delighted to be with you.
Where do you start?
Where do you start? I think the most important thing is to understand that what our educational system needs to do in terms of preparing our students for the 21st century. So our starting point is to recognize that we have to align our educational system with the needs of the U.S. economy, with the needs of states' economies, with the needs of regional and local economies, and make sure that our students have the skills they need to be effective citizens in the new global economy, but also effective workers in this new global economy. So that's the work we've been doing now for 6 years to try to identify for parents, for teachers, for administrators, for policymakers, what is the skill set that really matters in the 21st century, and how do we make sure that our educational system is now is starting to work to produce those skill outcomes for our young people.
Diana in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Diana.
Hello, Brian. Of course, I grew up in London, went to school there through 3 out of 4 years of college. And what I think one of the distinguishing factors is that our system was very, very demanding. Long school hours, you know, and everybody stayed. Of course, we did sports and so on, but time wasn't set aside the way it is here. And I think one of the main differences is that one had to articulate one's knowledge. In other words, you did your homework, and when you came to school, you had to discuss it. You had to get up in class, and you had to be articulate and defend your point. The same is true with much, much more intensity once you get to university. There were no book reports. There were no constant exams, you know, these minor little exams that you have. It was personal involvement. And I think, unfortunately, the system in England, when I was there, it was one in which one specialized, unfortunately, too young. You concentrated on certain subjects by the time you're in your mid-teens at the expense of others. But nevertheless, you learned what you learned very, very thoroughly. I think it was a demanding quality and the amount of homework that one had to do that forced you, I mean, really forced you to work. You had no alternative.
Diana, thank you very much. And we're going to go from Diana from England to Manhattan to Diane in Yonkers, originally from Jamaica, I think. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you? Very, very interesting program.
Thank you.
I'm glad for the opportunity to share this with you. I grew up in Jamaica and was educated there until age 18. I came here in 1991 and went straight into a school where I realized that it was a college, but I ended up teaching at the college instead of going to school at the college. Because the level of work you get is a step in advance of what you're getting here at the same age group.
Now, people may have heard the first Diana and now you and be thinking, well, maybe it's true in the UK, but when you come to a country like Jamaica, which is a low-income developing country, how is it that they could have a better education system than the United States? What would you say to those people?
I think the problem stems actually from the expectations at the other end when you come out in the job world. Because to get a banking job in Jamaica, you've got a teller level, you got to have 5 O-levels, and that's not easy to come by. Here in this country, you could just graduate from high school and you're sitting at a teller, as a teller at a bank. And I remember an experience I had where I had some foreign money that I had taken to Chase Bank one day to exchange, and I didn't know what the rate was, and I took it to the teller, and she looked up in a book, and then she said, this money was worth $2,000. I was astonished. I said, you're crazy. She said, no, it's $2,000. I said, oh, my God. 4 months later, Chase wrote me and said, there was an error. The money was only worth $2. Okay.
All right, Diana. At least Chase is one of the banks that still exists. But thank you for your call. And Ken Kay, president of the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, we've heard two stories now from two people. How much cross-international comparison have you done, and where do you start?
Well, first of all, let's deal with the comments from the UK. Two observations to make that I think are interesting. One is she commented that communication skills are undervalued in the United States. You can easily get out of a high school without having really good, effective communication skills, particularly oral communication skills. 85% of our jobs today are in the service economy, from low-end jobs to very high-end service economy jobs, which means that you have to relate to customers, you have to know how to communicate, you got to be able to understand their problems, empathize, you have to be able to customize solutions. We don't teach any of those skills today, particularly, as she said, oral communication skills aren't nearly as emphasized as they need to be. The other example I would give you is, as you're looking for what are other countries doing that we're not doing, the UK is a great example. They spent $35 million at the national level developing a technology literacy exam, and by 2009, every eighth grader in the UK will have to demonstrate technology competency for all kinds of reasons, for applications in the world, in the workforce. That's an investment that it gives you an idea of what some countries are doing.
That's a good one. And there are a lot of international students from India, China, the EU, attending universities in this country, and it seems like our institutions of higher education are better than many around the world, but not necessarily primary and secondary education. I want to go through a couple more calls. Ravish in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ravish.
Hi, how you doing, Brian?
Good. Originally from?
Originally from India. I just want to make a quick comment. We're running out of time, I see. I basically came to this country in the late 80s, and I was coming from eighth grade, and basically when I took the placement test with my guidance counselor, I realized that I was already at a level that was ahead. So instead of going into ninth grade, I was already put into 10th grade. And this is back in the early, you know, late 80s, early 90s. So, you know, obviously India has come a long way since then. And I just remember, and I also work as a teaching artist, by the way, now. I go into public schools to talk about education and music and different things, and I see the level they're at, so I can make a, you know, first-hand comparison. And, you know, for instance, six kids in sixth grade are barely getting to, like, things like pi r squared. They can't even do circumference, and we were doing that already, like, in fourth and fifth grade. So I'm just wondering.
Why do you think? Do you have a theory as to why?
Well, I mean, my personal sense is that I just don't see that sense of globalization. Like, I work in a lot of Latino and a lot of African-American schools in the South Bronx, Bed-Stuy, you know, Brownsville. I'm all over the place, and I just don't see that sense of urgency. I don't see any sense of we're not only competing with kids in Westchester or what have you, but we're competing with kids in, you know, kids like me, you know, who are coming up. You know, I mean, I came up from Bombay in Hyderabad, India, and, I mean, I went to a public school there, And
Ravish, I have to leave it there to get some other folks on, but thank you very much. And I think, Ken Kay, that the sense of urgency is missing in a lot of what he referred to as the schools in Westchester, meaning in, you know, even in some of the better suburbs. People get A's on our terms, and they seem to, you know, be smart, relatively affluent kids. I'm talking about upper middle class kids now, and yet they don't understand what's going on in places like where Ravish came from.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, one of the skills that we emphasize the most is self-direction and initiative as a 21st century skill. I think there's a national crisis in terms of lack of self-direction and initiative, and it's because our parents, our kids, have come through a period of relative affluency, and they're not feeling the crunch of every other kid in every other society waking up every morning knowing that they can compete effectively with American kids if
and
they
so
have the
we
right
get
initiative.
Get these numbers like the Program for Student Assessment, which measures achievements among 15-year-olds in 57 nations in the world. The U.S. ranked 36th in science and 35th in math. Shocking, considering that those are very internationally respected numbers. Soraya in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hang on, let me get Soraya in here, then we'll get a last word from you as we run out of time. Soraya?
Yes, hi.
You're originally from?
Iran.
And?
And I just want to share my experience coming to the U.S. when I was young, that America certainly teaches excellent creativity skills in our youngsters, arts and crafts and literature and thinking outside the box. But I have to tell you, people judge Iran as this third world rogue regime, and it's all over the news as this blasphemed country. But their education system is phenomenal. And in fact,
how are the literacy rates? Do you know?
In Iran?
Yes.
Very high. I mean, compared to the U.S. being a first world country, I would give it much more credit.
you know, relatively.
Soraya, thank you very much. Ken Kay, we have about a minute left for anything that you want to say and how you see the presidential candidates in terms of these international comparisons.
Well, just one thing. When you mentioned the Program for International Student Assessment, the reason those grades are particularly upsetting is that they're based on critical thinking and problem-solving skills, which are the skills of the 21st century. And so the more that you put in those international benchmarks, the skills that really matter, the worse we do. I would say that this has not been nearly the issue it needs to be in the presidential campaign, the issue of which are with whether our educational system is going to be viewed as a central implementer tool of U.S. competitiveness policy has not really been addressed, and I think it needs to be. And the point here is that we need to align our educational system and our competitiveness and our workforce development and economic development systems so they're all headed in the same direction.
Ken Kay, president of the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, which advocates for a major overhaul of the U.S. education system. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
And we have so many people from so many different countries who have migrated here who had comparisons and stories to tell about the education systems. We're going to have to do a part two of this one, I think. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. That's our 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 6. Education 08. Tomorrow, I will be off for Rosh Hashanah. Amy Eddings will be filling in. 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 7, will be about China and Russia. Tune in. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.